Broadcasting from the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C., welcome to The Peace Frequency, a podcast series searching for ways to create a world without violent conflict and finding them in the stories of people across the globe who are making peace possible. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. Joining me in studio for today's podcast is my guest, Gizem Kalinch. She is the lead coordinator for the United Network of Young Peacebuilders. This is a global network strengthening sustainable, youth-driven peacebuilding work, and they've been working with now 80 organizations across 45 countries. Gizem is in charge of UNOY's advocacy work and ensuring they work gender sensitively into their work. We are also joined in studio by Saba Ismail. She is the co-founder of Aware Girls, which is a young women-led organization working for women empowerment, gender equality, and peace in Pakistan. Saba was actually a guest on this podcast about several months ago, back in June, and so she's joining us again today as a co-host, if you will, since she works very closely with the United Network of Young Peacebuilders. So, Gizem and Saba, it's great to have you both in the studio today.
Thank you so much, Darren.
Thank you for having us here.
And for those of you who are listening to us, we're sitting here in the studio with our coffee, our tea, our water, and I'm really looking forward to a rich conversation because the both of you are right on the front lines of peacebuilding work with young people. And I think with all the conflicts, all the issues related to peace and justice that are happening in the world today, young people have been on the front lines, but perhaps have been their role on those front lines have been misunderstood, or the narrative around the role that young people have played and continue to play in peacebuilding maybe needs a little bit of a shift. And I think that's a lot of the work that you all have been doing. So I'm really excited for this conversation. Now, those of you who listen to this podcast know that we start every one of our shows with a behind the bio question. And this is a question that in your response, Gizem, will in some way reveal your inspirations, your motivations, your character. So we're going to start you off with this one. Since we are talking about young people and you yourself are a young person, but getting older every day, I want to take you back to maybe some of the earlier years in your youth. And my question is, if you could go back and you could relive any of your teenage years, what year would you want to relive? And a couple people, when they're asked this question, they think about it in a couple different ways. Some people say, oh, that year when I was 14, let's say, was so wonderful. I want to relive it because it was such an amazing moment in my life. Other people think about it, and this is not uncommon for our teenage years. They think of, oh, when I was 15, I made this really horrible mistake, and that really impacted my life or somebody else's life in a certain way, and I wish I could go back and do it all over again. So there's a couple different ways you could tackle this question, but I leave it to you. Go back, relive any of your teenage years. Which would it be, and why?
Okay, so that would be my first year in secondary school. I was 12 years old, and I had just completed primary school, so I transitioned to a completely new school. And in my primary school, I was teased a lot. I was sometimes bullied. I was one of the shorter people in my class. So I think when I went to my new secondary school in a completely different neighborhood, starting anew, I had made this maybe slightly subconscious decision that I would compensate for my height by having a very big mouth, by being very loud and feisty, by being very present and vocal in the school. And looking back on my teenage years, I remember mostly really nice things, a lot of moments in my teenage bedroom, exploring books, exploring CDs, as young people tend to do, spending a lot of time in their bedrooms. But at the same time, I also remember being a lot of resistance towards teachers, specifically. So not really towards my peers, but towards teachers, always questioning when I would get certain assignments and staging, I don't know, like a demonstration where young people would leave the classroom because I felt, I don't know, we were being done some injustice or something. So very big gesture is a bit dramatic, over the top, and not really taking the time to address it in maybe a less, I don't know, a more constructive way. And I've also, one of the moments where I was realizing that maybe my behavior was a bit inappropriate was when one of the teachers came to me and he said, I know that you completely despise me and you hate me, but I really need you to do this or that, or I don't know what the exact reason was for this conversation, but that really made me think of, oh, wow, I've been making their lives very difficult, and often I'm sure that a lot of things are coming from a very good place. And so I would like to go back to those years. I've actually had a dream once where I was on a big stage. Year, I think it was 10 years after I was 12, so I was about 22. I had a dream that I was on a big stage and I was apologizing to all my teachers and just explaining what was going through my mind and why I was maybe behaving like that. So going back and, yeah, maybe approaching things a bit differently.
Salva, what about you? The question that we asked you, I believe, when you were on the show, correct me if I'm wrong, was, yeah, if you could teach a course on your philosophy of life and there was one book that was going to be required reading for all the students, what would that book be and why? I remember your response being very interesting, but I'm going to throw this one to you as well. Same question that Gizem got. If you could go back and relive one of your teenage years, which one would it be and why?
Okay, so I thought I'm the co-host, so maybe I'm not. I will not be answering all of the questions, but well, yeah. So yeah, if I would like to actually go back to my teenage years, I think that will be 15, 16 years when I was 15, 16 years old, and at that time, actually, the reason why I would like to go back was that that I would like to fix a problem to go back. And the problem was that I met a woman whose son was taken away by the militant groups. And the son actually didn't inform his parents that he is that he's going for jihad. He's going for the holy war, and the family actually received the dead body after a few months. And this mother told me this story, and at that time I was almost 15, 16 years. And I think that woman, her eyes still haunt me, and the pain in her eyes, it's still like, you know, they still follow me. And I most of the time, I think that if there was like a time machine in which I could go back to the past, I would just go back, and I would, by any means, if I could just bring her son back to her mother, and if I can rejoin them, that will be something that I will say that, okay, I'm like, you know, I have due justice to my teenage years.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get into specifically the work that you both do with United Network of Young Peacebuilders, but in both of your responses, I heard something that I commonly attach to or ascribe to young people, particularly teenagers, which is, I think at that moment in our lives, we understand the world enough, we understand ourselves enough, our emotions, our feelings, our reactions, and we're able to think critically or analyze things to a certain level, but we're not yet old enough to have been taught how to accept certain things or be told that things are the way they are and kind of just get used to it. So, you know, when you're looking at a mother's eyes and you're haunted by those, the emotion that she's feeling, receiving that as a teenager, I think is different than if you were 40 or 50 years old. Now, I don't want to stereotype and paint all older people with a broad brush, but I think at that moment in your life, there's that sense that you're able to receive a lot of those emotions and feelings in ways that you may be numb to later in life. And Gizem, when you talked about being fierce and ferocious, you know, when you were in secondary school, this sense of injustice, it's like when you're a young kid, it's what's fair and unfair. But then at around 12, 13, 14, you start to develop that sense of justice and what is injustice and how to stand up against it. And sometimes maybe we go a bit extreme, but I think that's a spirit that is so important. And so that's why I think the work that both of you do with young people as young people is so essential to the challenges that we not just face today, but the challenges that this world has faced for generations, generations, centuries and centuries. So let's talk a little bit about the United Network of Young Peacebuilders. Gizem, could you tell us, what is this network? What is its mission, and what do you do as its lead coordinator?
Okay. First of all, I'm not the lead coordinator. I'm the leading coordinator, which means there's another leading coordinator. So we're an international network of youth-led organizations working on peace and security issues. And as many other youth organizations, we have split up the leadership in two people because there's a high turnover of – at some point, you're no longer youth. So it's no longer – it wouldn't be legitimate for me to be a 45-year-old and saying that I represent different young people across the world, but no longer fitting in that category. So that's why we have this shared leadership. So when, because of the high turnover of people coming in and out and being part of the movement, it's also good that there is some person that remains, that some of the learning and some of the experiences and the connections that we have built up, that it's still captured in one of the people. So that's why we have a shared leadership. And I think this is a model that maybe other organizations could also apply, regardless of whether a youth organization or not. But what we do, well, you've mentioned that we have many different members across the world. And our members, they really vary in shapes and sizes. They might not all have the word peace in the name of their organization, because peace building can mean many different things across the world. And some of our members, they tend to focus more on the access of young women to education, whereas others, they talk more about migration or about preventing violent extremism in their communities. So there are different ways in which our network members are working on issues of peace building. But one of the things that unites us is that we want to create more opportunities for young people to make positive contributions, and also really to gain recognition for all the work that we are doing. As you were saying earlier, there's youth are often being portrayed as victims when we talk about armed conflict or about peace and security issues, or they're seen as perpetrators of violence, but there's not enough visibility for all the great work that is being done within our network and beyond our network. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to create a space where young people can get together, learn, share, work together, and get inspired by each other. We're also really channeling all of these experiences that are taking place often at the very local level to international policy processes, policy arenas, but also, yeah, to bring these youth voices to the international level. That's what we're able to do as a network.
So I'm going to ask this question. Anytime we talk about young people, there are some different definitions for what constitutes a young person. So what is UNOY's definition of a young person? When do you cease to be a young person?
We don't have a formal definition of youth. This is simply for the reason that there's different ways of seeing this, depending on where you live in the world. You might be a young person as long as you don't get married, you're a young person, regardless of whether you're 50 years old or not. In other cases, so there are different perceptions of what youth is. The same in where I'm from, in the Netherlands. So we are very careful of not making any restrictions, not excluding anyone, and also being mindful of these different realities all over the world. There is a definition by the UN, which is
24.
But in a recent resolution on youth, peace, and security, it has been extended to 29. So this is maybe a definition that we keep in the back of our mind. But as I said, we are very careful in making any final
definitive. Interesting.
Exactly.
Interesting. So yeah, I stopped being a young person a long time ago, I guess. Mm-hmm. Shared leadership. So this is interesting. You are a leading coordinator, and there's one other leading coordinator, as you said. Is there an age difference, meaning that one of those leading coordinators gets phased out first so that one remains for a couple more years with that institutional memory?
Not intentionally. Okay. It might happen. There is an age difference between me and my co-leader, but that's not intentional, no.
Okay. And then, Saba, how long have you been involved with UNOY, and how did you first get involved with them?
Well, so actually, our my involvement with UNOY, it's a very old relationship and a very long relationship. I'm actually connected with UNOY through another hat, which is actually I co-founded also another organization that is called CRY, it's Coalition on Rights and Responsibilities of Youth, which is a youth-led organization based in Pakistan. And CRY is a member organization of UNOY. We are actually CRY is a member of UNOY for more than a decade, almost now. It's 11 years now, so we are engaged from quite for a long time with UNOY in different capacities. We have been engaged as, for example, we have engaged with UNOY, like UNOY has built our capacity. The members, they have built the capacity of our members in different aspects, in peace building, in conflict resolution, and, you know, in different areas of our work. I was also, so there is actually, there is another mechanism in UNOY. It's called the International Steering Committee. So it is actually composed of, it is an International Steering Committee. It's like, you know, it is a committee. It is, and it has, the committee has a representative from each region, from African regions, two from African regions, from Asia, from Latin America, from European regions. And usually there are seven people. Usually there are seven people.
We've added one to represent Middle East and North Africa.
Okay. So I was actually the ISG member for 2 years. So I served on that steering committee as well. And the ISG actually also take decisions on when there are any member applications from for the UNOY. So if any organization wants to join the network, they apply for they do send their information, and there is a specific criteria. So when they send their application, so it is the responsibility of ISG to take decisions. So that's why that it's really, like, you know, my engagement with this is also that we have been given this opportunity as being the decision makers in the network as well, and not only being, you know, you're just members and, you know, not at that. So it's really a very good way to actually give the opportunity to young people to be in the decision-making processes of the network. There is another component in which I'm engaged with UNOY, which is called Youth Advocacy Team. It is actually a global, it's an advocacy group of young people who are working on global advocacy issues. And maybe we can talk, actually we will talk about you and about the YAT in more detail in the coming, in the discussion. But I joined YAT group in October 2015, and we have been done advocacy for the resolution 2215. Today we are going to talk about it later.
Wonderful. So.
Yes, about the International Steering Group, the great thing about it is that the different members, so they're elected per region and they're elected by our member organizations. So they also represent our member organizations, and it really makes sure that our network is democratic, inclusive, and it's not just a secretariat, which is based in The Hague in the Netherlands, out there making decisions, but the International Steering Group, which is representing the different members, is the decision-making body.
Okay. Oh, interesting. And so let's talk a little bit more about this process, because I think this is interesting where, you know, you mentioned earlier the shared leadership model, which is fascinating, this youth-led steering group that represents the various organizations that are part of it. And you mentioned that there is some criteria. But earlier, Gizem, you said that not all these organizations have the word peacebuilding in their name. They work on gender issues or preventing violent extremism. So how does this group, and how large is the group? Seven members, you said? Seven folks?
They have been added now. So
that's the IHG.
They have to represent, there has to be a representation from every region.
From every region. Okay. So it's like in many ways, maybe it's not, a mini United Nations, where there's a lot of different competing interests, I assume, understandings of youth, what constitutes peace building and what doesn't. How does the group navigate some of those challenges when an organization comes and says, I want to join this network, and that application or their information is put in front of the group? How do they, you know, create that criteria?
the criteria for membership, they're on the one hand very simple, but on the other hand they're not, because they're kind of fluid and open, as you were already referring to. So now on the one hand, if you want to become a part of the UNY network, you have to be youth-led. So that means that the leadership has to be youth. But as we already said earlier, the youth, again, it could be different things, but we do have this...
Actually, there is, like, there may not be a specific age, maybe for UNY leadership, but there is, like, you know, the criteria that I was talking about is that it has to be one led by young people, and they have to work on peace, you know. But the peace, it is up to the organization that how they define peace.
Exactly.
You know? It can be according to their local context, how they define peace. For some, it can be the right to education. For others, it can be working in conflict settings. For some, it can be pre-conflict and during conflict. So for some, it can be post. So, you know, for some people, it can be the issue of migration. For some, it can be humanitarian response. For some, it can be, you know, it's different. It's different for people. But when they apply, you know, it's the application, all the details go to the international steering group, and they see if the organization is, one, it's a valid organization, you know, in terms of that it exists in reality or not. And that is actually the reason that, you know, when we have a representative from every region, and these members of the ISG, actually, they do have a lot of networks, and they do other organizations, other young people in their own
circles,
regions,
yeah.
In their own circles. So they have to make sure that this is, you know, this group is existing. And sometimes we have to check, you know, this is one of the things, and also that they are committed to the values of the the UNY. So if they are committed to the values and norms,
You're listening to The Peace Frequency, a podcast series searching for ways to create a world without violent conflict and finding them in the stories of people across the globe who are making peace possible. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge, and we are speaking today with our guest, Gizem Kilinch. She's a leading coordinator for UNY Peace Builder, and we're also joined by Saba Ismail, who's the co-founder of Aware Girls. Gizem, I want to delve a little bit deeper into your story and how you got to where you are today in this role with UNY. First, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Rotterdam. In one of the neighborhoods there. And it is still a neighborhood with a lot of people coming from different walks of life, different parts of the world, who have at some point migrated to the Netherlands for various reasons. And also a neighborhood that the local authorities often depicted as a problematic one, a socially or economically disadvantaged neighborhood. Even though in my experiences, I remember being invited to a lot of cool cultural initiatives, maybe because there was so much attention for this neighborhood, and having great friends and just being part of a very dynamic and culturally diverse and culturally rich neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And then when did you grow up? And here's what I mean by that. What was happening, or what were some moments that you recall growing up that you feel really shaped who you are today and how you think and what you're passionate about? You know, some people point to whether it's a personal conflict, a family conflict, a national or global issue. Were there moments where you're like, you know what, that really shaped or triggered something in me that I hold as being a defining moment in my life?
So, as I described, I grew up in a neighborhood in Rotterdam, Netherlands, which is a peaceful country. But my parents and my sister, they're from mountains. They're not from this flat country at all. They were born in the eastern part of Turkey, the Kurdish region. And they were forced by circumstances to flee their homes and to seek refuge in the Netherlands. And this is not something I was always very aware of, because I was born and raised in the Netherlands. And slowly with age, realizing that my parents couldn't return to Turkey, even when family members, for instance, were ill or something nice had happened, a new baby was born, and not being able to be near to those people and not being able to go back. And so slowly gaining more awareness of the Kurdish conflict in Turkey, understanding that, realizing that this was mostly addressed through weapons, through fighting, through armed groups that were trying to make some of the issues visible. So becoming more and more aware of that, having conversations with my family members, with their friends who have also, so the refugee community in the Netherlands, and just thinking about, is there an alternative to weapons? Is there a different way that we can address these issues? Trying to understand what is happening, the history of it. So deciding to study international relations and wanting to do conflict analysis and conflict studies. And so I think, yeah, slowly discovering my family's history, understanding why I was born in this suburb of Rotterdam, whereas my parents were from somewhere else, and just making sense of all of those things, I think that has been very formative in my life.
And how much older is your sister?
She's 7 years older.
Okay. And I assume, but maybe incorrectly, have you had a chance to sit down with your mom and your sister and talk about the circumstances that led them to move and come to the Netherlands?
Yes, but as I mentioned, at a slightly later age, because my parents, they weren't very, although I knew they were still thinking and talking about these issues and trying to also raise awareness from their new homes in the Netherlands. It was until maybe my teenage years that we started talking about it more explicitly. And also hearing from my parents that they were maybe reconsidering some of their ideas and thinking that dialogue and bringing people together and creating nonviolent ways of talking about these issues is the way forward, and that this is the only way that we can come to a sustainable solution for the issue.
Mm-hmm. Have you been to Turkey?
I've been to Turkey when I was 12 with my mom. It was the year after she was able to go back. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think I would be... I've always considered myself Dutch. It wasn't until other people would ask me, where are you really from? Oh, this name doesn't sound Dutch. And getting slightly annoyed about that. So being, it wasn't until people would ask me these questions, always about my identity and my name, that I would realize, like, maybe there's more to me than just being Dutch. But then the moment I arrived to the hometown of my parents, seeing those mountains, that really did something with to me. Also, this conflict that I'm mentioning, it's still ongoing. Mm-hmm. There was a bit of progress up until very recently. Things are escalating again in the last years. And just... I didn't think it would have such an impact on me, that this faraway place that you've never been, that you can feel some sort of connection to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I had a similar experience. My dad, born and raised in Guyana in South America, and the last time he's been there, I think, was 1976. And so my sister and I were born and were living our lives, and we knew that my dad was from this country called Guyana, and we'd been to the West Indian and the Caribbean a lot, which... Guyana is a West Indian culture. They don't speak Spanish or anything like much the rest of the South American continent. But so we were in some way connected to that culture and that identity, but I had never been to Guyana. So 2008, I think, I just went with a friend of mine and was surprised how I felt there too. I was there for, I think, 10 days or so. And yeah, I loved it. It's like, how do you... There's something about it where you're like, I'm connected to this place, even though I've never been here before. But the sounds, the smells, the landscape, all those things, I felt at home, which I think was my dad found, I think, surprising a little bit, because he still hasn't been back since the mid-70s, though his older brother and his younger brother go back all the time. They go back several times a year. So it's interesting how different family members respond different ways to, you know, why you leave a country and whether or not you want to go back and what you attach to it and things like that. Well, thanks for sharing all of that. Are there, you mentioned that the Kurdish conflict is still ongoing. Are there other things that you remember growing up that you feel are persistent conflicts, intractable conflicts, dare I use that word, intractable conflicts, or examples of history repeating itself where, you know, when you were 8, 9, or 10, this was happening in the world, and now, you're working at UNOY and you're much older, but you're thinking, we've faced this problem before and it's just re-emerged in a new form. And I ask this question because one of my icons is Congressman John Lewis. He's a prolific civil rights leader here in the United States, worked with Dr. King and was on the front lines of nonviolent movements here in the United States. And now he's a congressman from Georgia. And there has been a spike in hate crimes here in the United States, racist assaults and things like that. And in a recent speech, he said that he feels like he's fighting those same fights all over again, and that he never thought that he would necessarily be saying those words however many years, decades later, but he feels like he's returning back to some of those same fights. Are there things that you – I mean, still being a young person, I mean, John Lewis is much, much older, so I think there's more for him to draw from. But are there types of conflicts that you feel constantly recycle themselves?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And maybe focusing on one particular thing. So already we've been talking about the perceptions of youth. And I feel that this negative perception of young people as troublemakers, as being inactive, as being not interested, not engaged with what's happening in their communities, it's a narrative that repeats itself over and over and over again. Earlier today, we were speaking with someone from the World Bank, Matthias Lundberg, and he was quoting a quote which had a similar message about how young people, they're up to no good. And if the young people today would be responsible for the future, that there would, it looks very bleak. And this quote was from, I can't remember the exact
century. It was century, from 8th century. 8th.
Before Christ. Before Christ. So that was, again, one of those eye-opening moments. Also, when you hear back about the 60s and the 70s, mm-hmm. and if my dad describes how he... how his elders in his community looked at the young people. I feel like this is a narrative that constantly repeats itself, maybe because at some point young people, they grow out of being young. And I don't have the exact answer for it, why this is the case. But it does seem like once people reach a phase where they're no longer considering themselves as youth, that they kind of forget that they at one point were also described as not having a role to play in important processes, in decision-making, that does affect the life of young people. And we are being held accountable, but yet we don't have access to some of these spaces. So it's very interesting to see how this repeats itself.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, let's unpack that a little bit more. I mean, it's this timeless narrative that young people are victims or perpetrators of conflict. Let's talk about that a little bit more. I mean, why do we think that is? Why has this narrative, been allowed to continue in some eras, perhaps gain momentum? Is there some truth behind that narrative? This is to both of you. Mm-hmm. Why has it remained so persistent? And I know 2250, and we're going to get to that, seeks to address that, but I'd love to just unpack that the existing narrative a little bit more.
When you ask me if is there any truth to it, I say no. Mm. A majority of young people does not resort to violence. They might not be super active in peace building, but they do not resort to violence. And a majority of a part of that majority, as we can see from our network, are engaged in ways of addressing peace and security issues in nonviolent ways. So I don't think there's truth to it. But yet these are the stories that come up in the newspapers that make it to the forefront. And I'm sure that for every example of young people being engaged in armed groups or in militia, there's also young people trying to address that and trying to find other ways of doing that. That's the feeling that I get from our network, because there are so many examples from everywhere in the world that I see where young people are making positive contributions and trying to address. But yeah, I don't think there's any truth to it. But I haven't answered your question yet about why is this narrative in place then?
Mm.
So I agree with what Gizem said, that it is, well, it's not true that young people are like, you know, the violent group of people, and they are so joining, you know, not only joining, they are engaged in violent activities. It's not true. The only problem why it is so much perceived, or the world knows about the bad things about young people, is that so much attention has been focused to this aspect of young people. But if we see on the other hand, there are young people who are doing amazing work, even in our, you just take example of UNOY, because we are here today discussing about UNOY. So 80 member organizations, you know, all our youth-led organizations, all are working amazing things.
Mostly volunteer-run.
Most of them, yeah, mostly volunteer-run in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, in Europe, in Middle East, you see. So they are doing so much, but we can see that the focus is never, like, you know, the torchlight is never on these young people. And we can see that there are so many young people who, there is a very small fraction of young people who are engaged in violent activities. And when they see that, yes, you know, they are not being given this, they're not being acknowledged, they're not being, their voices are not heard, their issues are not, you know, not important for anyone, and they're not taken seriously. And when they see that how much attention is being given to all these militant groups, for example, you know, and what, when something happens, you know, how much attention the world gives to them, and they're like, look, all the world is listening to them, to these young people to these people who are doing bad things. So why not just go and join these bad people so that world can listen to us? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the problem, you know, that's the problem. And we need to fix that. I know that there is, we don't have like a clear cut answer, because, there is also a reason behind that, because it's not, you know, it's not a one, there is no one solution to it. We have to see different factors that actually lead to this problem. And we have to fix all those many, many factors that can be, for example, civic factors. There are political factors. There are, there are security factors. There are, there are a whole lot of factors, societal factors, community factors. So we have to see all of those things that were, what are this, you know, and we have to fix those. I'll just give one example, you know, in terms of like figures, in terms of a few figures that, for example, in the work that I am doing is that I am directly engaging 600 young people in peace building and conflict resolution. And they are reaching out to other 6,000 people. So they are reaching. So this is like, you know, we can see that how the young people, if, for example, someone say that, okay, yeah, but where is the evidence? Or if we talk about, you know, when you said that, you know, from where these perceptions come. So we have to give the importance to these 6,000 people who are engaged in these activities, who are engaged in these programs. And the world has to see them. The world has to see a different picture. And also the world has to see the alternative narratives. Mm-hmm. Mm. And I think the world, the whole world lacks those alternatives. The only perception that has been given to the people is young people. There is a huge population. There are 1.8 billion people. Am I correct? I think it's 1.8 billion, yeah. 1.8 billion young people in the world, they are the problem. This is the youth bulge. Let's mm-hmm. tackle them, you know. And then that's why when leaders come and when there are always, when they talk, when they have to give a speech to young people, they're like, yeah, you are the leaders, you know.
Of the future, not of the present.
Yeah, you are the leaders, exactly. You are very right, Gizem, that we are always being dealt as the leaders of the future, leaders of tomorrow, you know. And I'm like, come on, no. There are leaders, there are young people who are leading these campaigns into these communities. There are these 80 organizations from UNOY who are the leaders.
Right.
And
now,
who have proven that they are the leaders, you know. Mm. So.
Mm. I hear you. I totally hear you. I think the point you made about when attention is given to armed violent actors and they're covered, whether it's positive or negative, it's attention, for lack of a better word. And so if you want to be heard, when those types of groups get that type of coverage, it can be seductive to say, I'm going to join that group. So what ends up happening is, you know, you look at armed groups like the FARC, a lot of folk 18 to 29 involved in FARC, and in many ways shaped that country of Colombia for 50 years in that conflict. That's a lot of power. And now we've seen some progress. This is great. You look at the Tamil Tigers and that decades-long civil war, young people, children. You look at Boko Haram, other extremist groups, ISIS, you know, attracting a lot of young people. So I think there is – I understand also where those who embrace and endorse and perpetuate the narrative of young people being violent actors bears some fruit, in the sense that if you look at some of these longest conflicts, you know, folks who pick up a gun in any type of armed conflict, whether it's a state actor or non-state actor – are, but correct me if I'm wrong, I'm assuming are young men primarily, 18 to 29, they fit that scope. So it's easy to kind of fall into that narrative. So here's my question, because I hear you and I agree with you. And so part of your work is to shift that narrative and highlight large groups of young people that are doing all this transformative work, shaping culture, shaping politics, transforming conflicts, through peaceful means, nonviolent means. So this is probably not the best way to phrase the question, but what is the peace alternative to groups like ISIS or groups like the FARC? Because there is something appealing about group solidarity, identity, attention, power. What is the peace and nonviolent alternatives? And I know you know why. I have got organizations that present that. So tell me about some of those.
Just want to go back to the gun that you were talking about that these young people are picking up. Where are these guns coming from? Who is trading them? Is that young people? No, these are governments. These are arms trade. I mean, I don't know. That's, for me, that's a really troubling thing when I'm talking to policymakers and they're telling me that I'm doing great work, but at the same time, you know, they're heavily involved and profiting from arms trade. But that's just a little side note. So you're talking about peaceful alternatives, spaces where young people can create meaning for their life, build an identity, feel that they're in control, that they can influence decisions that affect their lives. Peaceful alternatives to that. Well, there are different ways of Saba, maybe you could highlight how you're addressing this in Pakistan and in the spaces that you're trying to create and the different initiatives.
Sure, I will. So my response to this is that young people in many of these militant groups are being used as the face of militants. They are used as a face, and in many cases of these militant groups, when we see they're not the brains of these militant groups. So they are being controlled, they are being used in many different ways to create fear and terror in these communities. Their young people are, you know, how their emotions are used, how their spirit and their emotions, their connection to the religion has been misinterpreted and used in all of these situations in different ways. So that is one point, and then coming to the different alternative narratives that I was speaking earlier, and now as you asked about the different non-violent alternative narratives, I would like to share the example of the work that I am doing in Pakistan. Is that we have established a network of young peace builders, which is called Youth Peace Network, in which we build the capacity of young people as peace builders and as agents of change. And when they, these young people, when their capacities are built, they go back into their communities, and they work through peer-to-peer education model. So through this model, they reach out to other young people who are vulnerable to be recruited by the militant groups, or who are actually in different ways can support the militant groups. So they reach out to those, and they prevent young people to be recruited by focus group discussions, by having open discussions with them, by having different seminars, workshop, like with a smaller level in the community level, also by organizing different creative activities with them. So they have to be like, you know, all of these, all of the work that they are doing, it is like, you know, the members of the Youth Peace Network are doing is also they are creating bridges between the communities. And also between the communities from different different religious backgrounds. So giving a platform for people from different religious backgrounds to sit together on one platform and discuss what their religions are teaching about peace, and also to break the myths and stereotype about other religions, because it has been used a lot by these in recruiting young people, because they are being taught that, you know, for example, non-Westerns or non-Muslims, it's a sin to eat with them. It's a sin even to shake hands with them. And, you know, these kind of things are so much ingrained into their minds. And so that's why we think that it's really important to give these alternative platforms for young people to where they can listen to these alternative narratives. And also working with the, for example, we also work with the literary communities, the literary societies. So, for example, the people who are like poets or who sing like poetry, and because these are the communities who are also being targeted by the militant groups, because, you know, these poets, they do write, you know, what's happening on the ground, and most of the cases they write they are political as well. They share how these people have been gone through, and then these are also being the target by the militant groups, and people don't have the opportunity to listen, to actually understand, you know, the phenomena and the agenda behind the militancy, and that's why they are being blocked from the society. So what we do is we are giving even those spaces for young people to sit together, to listen to those poetry, to listen, to have a discussion with these poets as well. So we are using many different, alternative narratives and out of the box, you know, alternatives. So not the typical ones, but we always, like, you know, we support these young people. So if they come up with any different ideas, so we do support if it's any idea by these young people, which it's not like, so we are always there to mentor the members of the Youth Peace Network. We're there to support them.
Yeah, and that's very much in line with what I see more broadly in our network, that either there some of our members, they take a bit more of an arts-based approach to peace building. There's an example of our member in Northern Ireland where there's a lot of polarization between different religious groups, and they are managing to bridge these divides and using techniques from theater to analyze what's been happening in the country and bringing together young people that normally wouldn't meet otherwise. Also what you were saying about really just through even trainings or workshops or other types of gathering, just really making it clear to young people that you do have a role to play, that you can affect decision making. And I think we have some really powerful examples also in our network, such as the resolution 2250 that we've mentioned a few times now. That resolution, it's a UN Security Council resolution. It's been adopted in December last year in 2015, so it's nearly 1 year old.
Yeah.
And the resolution really came about because we had this shared sense of not being recognized as peace builders, always being put aside in negative portrayals, and really wanting recognition from the highest political authority in peace and security, which is the Security Council. So we've mobilized young people, we've worked together, we organized missions to the UN, we kept on bringing in these very local experiences, our own personal stories, the things that we witness in around us, bringing those to the international level policy arenas and explaining why it's important that youth are supported in their efforts to build peaceful and inclusive societies.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Peace Frequency, a podcast series searching for ways to create a world without violent conflict and finding them in the stories of people across the globe who are making peace possible. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge, and we're speaking with our guest, Gizem Killinch?
Yes.
Who is a leading coordinator for UNOY Peace Builders. And also joining us in studio is Saba Ismail. She's the co-founder of Aware Girls and was a guest on the podcast several months ago. So let's go deeper into 2250. First question is, why would anybody oppose this resolution? Why was it even a challenge to get this resolution passed?
Because, one of the things that, so when we were going on these missions to New York to speak to different people who are part of UN departments and agencies or permanent representative ambassadors from different member states. Doors might open, and they might be very interested in taking a photo and thinking that it was very cute that this group of young people have been organizing themselves and talking about these issues, but then really not understanding why it's important to involve youth. You'd be surprised that it was still actually quite, we had to make a strong case. It was quite difficult to convince people of the importance of involving nearly the majority of the world population in peace processes, in decision-making.
Yeah, so when these YAT missions were actually going to New York, actually, so we were told that, you know, you have come up with it's a really good idea that you want to have, like, a resolution on youth peace and security. But, you know, it will take maybe 20 years for this idea to be accepted in the UN. And we were like, okay, so
I mean, did they explain that? Why 20 years to accept this?
Many
resolution?
People, maybe again, coming to that point, many people want to work with young people and not, you know, maybe
sharing the actual space and sitting around the table with young people, but more talking about youth, maybe sometimes consulting them, but not necessarily wanting to share power. Mm-hmm. It's that simple, yeah. I think. Mm.
But it didn't take 20 years.
Yeah, no, luckily we have an amazing team of of young people. And also because it was a teamwork, you know, this resolution was possible because of many, many other partners in this process with Search for Common Ground, World Vision, other UN agencies like UNDP, UNFPA, PBSO, Peace Building Support Office. So it was a collaborative effort. That's why it was possible. Otherwise, and yes, I would really not forget to mention Ahmed Al-Hindawi, who is the UN Youth Envoy. He also played a very important role in this resolution. And Jordan also played the major role because Jordan was the country in the Security Council. So they were members, and they were actually about to their membership was till December last year. And we were lucky enough to get their support, and they were able to push the agenda. And that's, they actually organized a global forum
on youth, peace, and security.
Yeah. So in Jordan, a few months before this, before the resolution, and there was an Amman declaration, which actually many of the points, this Amman declaration was drawn upon by more than 10,000 young people. And it actually laid the basis of this, you know, the text of the resolution. And so I guess this is like, you know, all the young people who played their role, all the member states that help us, all other partners, I guess it was possible with all of them.
Through a very strong partnership with NGOs, UN departments, youth groups.
So putting your historian hats on, when did this effort really begin? If you were writing the story of the passage of 2250, did it take 5 years, 10 years, 1 year? When did the momentum really start to build for this resolution to be considered and then passed?
I think there was already talk of it in 2012.
Yes.
But it was not until 2014 when there was we were renewing our youth advocacy team, our global youth advocacy team, to really coming up with a concrete strategy on what is it that we want to achieve, and which bodies should we engage, what would we like to see, how would we want to strengthen the opportunities for youth participation in peace building. And that's putting those heads together, developing this strategy as a group of young people across the world, around 2014, and then the different meetings that have taken place since, identifying great friends and allies within the different actors that we just mentioned, and really pushing for this, being very loud, being very vocal, being persistent, not stopping when people are telling you maybe you should focus on the General Assembly, maybe we'll take 20 years, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. No, just being persistent and working together.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations. I mean, I can't imagine what it must have felt like when it did pass. And like you said, coming up on the one-year anniversary. I remember seeing some pictures on Facebook. We have some mutual friends and seeing the celebration and the looks on people's faces of what an accomplishment to get a resolution passed, considered and then passed in the United Nations, particularly in the face of folks who had been telling you, oh, yeah, maybe 20 years down the road when, you know, you're in a completely different generation, or for years and they hadn't been taking you seriously, maybe just as photo ops. So I think that's a huge achievement, and my hat's off to both of you and all the organizations that you mentioned getting this passed and now coming up on the one-year anniversary. But I think a lot of our listeners are going to ask the question, so what? What does a UN resolution actually do? How does the work of the United Nations, how does international relations, how does peace-building work change at all based off of a resolution? So in particular, let's look at 2250. How is the work of peace-building, international relations, the United Nations going to change at all because this was passed?
Good question, because let's be real about it. At the end of the day, it's a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And there are many pieces of paper out there in New York and other places. There are many policy frameworks. And it will not have the impact that we are envisioning if it will not be translated to actual change. And if we're not able to bring it closer to home, so outside of this policy bubble, to our regional levels, to our national countries, to the very local communities that we live in. And the difference that it's made and it's, that it's already making that I can see is that our members and other young people who are working on, have been working on these issues for many years are now able to bring in this what I called a piece of paper, but which is actually a legally binding document, and they are able to say, I'm doing this. This is legally binding. You're a member state of the UN. You need to support me. I want financial support. I want practical support. I want your technical expertise.
That's what this. I want to be taken seriously.
I want to be taken seriously. This document is calling for practical, logistical, financial support to youth efforts in peace building. So we are able to use this document as a way to legitimize our work, to it's really a tool. It's a really a means to talk to people that we might not be able to talk to, make things happen that we wouldn't otherwise. It gives weight to the demands that we have. And some of the things that have happened since 1 year, since the adoption, is that we've realized there's very little evidence on the impact that youth-led peacebuilding can have on their communities. What is actually the impact that it has? There is no evidence because this is a new agenda. There has never been that much attention for youth peace and security other than, as we were saying, youth as perpetrators or youth as victims. So this is the first time that we're actually, the resolution mandates the UN Secretary General to carry out a baseline study, a progress study, to see what are young people doing out there and what is the impact of their work. Let's measure it. Let's monitor it. Let's have statistics. Let's have stories. Let's have let's compile this in a report, which will be presented at the end of 2017. And this report will also lead to recommendations to see how the resolution can be implemented, because it's a very comprehensive document. It points at participation. It looks at prevention. It looks at partnerships. It looks at disengagement and reintegration of young people who were formerly engaged in violence. It looks at all sorts of things. So the progress study, it will come up with indicators, it will come up with recommendations that will be presented to the Security Council. So that progress study is very much in progress right now. Saba, she's actually personally involved in it.
So I'm actually involved in this, in the progress study. And as Giza mentioned, that yes, we realized after the resolution and in this 1 year that there is a lack of evidence on the issue of youth peace and security. And the reason that's why this research, this study is actually mandated by the Security Council, and we are working on having on actually collecting the evidence. So there has been work already done, but we need to collect that evidence, the examples of amazing young people who are already doing this amazing work, but we need to collect it and we need to present it. We will be presenting it back to the Security Council. And it's really important because this the recommendations drawn from this study We see that they will be, this study will be used as, again, as a tool to implement this resolution at the country level as well, and also to develop national action plans by the member states. And I think that's where I see that, you know, it is, we know that why this resolution and the study now is important for us, because it was an achievement that UN has recognized us, the young people, as positive peace builders, as positive. Like, you know, it has given us that, it has acknowledged our work, but it's also important that the governments, you know, the member states and the governments also actually now implement, as Gizim was saying, that now they are legally binded to this. They have to take actions, you know. They have to engage young people. They have to make sure that young people are there in the policy making, in the decision making processes. They are there in the international peace processes as well. Mm-hmm. So it can, now, for example, if there is any international peace processes going on, and if we as young people, if we demand that there are no young people, now we have a document to reflect, you know, use as a document that, see, we have a space here, and you cannot exclude us just being based on the basis of our age or either on the basis of our gender. So mm-hmm. it's not going to happen at all. And I think that's the most powerful thing of this resolution.
Mm. Very exciting. I look forward to that. I can't wait. You said end of 2017 is when the deadline. That's exciting. Well, we're coming to the end of our time, so I appreciate you all hanging out as long as you possibly can, because I know you've had a busy day. You haven't had lunch, and you're surviving on peanuts and granola bars at this point. But a couple last questions. You know, United Network of Young Peace Builders, UNOY, is in a unique situation because you have direct contact with so many different types of youth-led organizations from so many different parts of the world. So just off of your own experience so far in your position, Gizem, are there any issues that you feel are trending, or that a lot of people, regardless of where they are in the world, seems to be an issue that touches on people or people focus on regardless of where they are in the world? So I'm thinking of things like, you know, climate change or gender equality or preventing violent extremism or, you know, democracy and governance. When you look at the 80 member organizations of UNOY, are there some of those issues that you're like, wow, a good number of those organizations are focusing on this particular issue? Or is it incredibly diverse and it's hard to say that there's one issue that's trending at this moment in history?
I'd say it's very diverse. All of the issues that you've mentioned, they're relevant to all of our members, but it might not be on the top of their priority list. I think one thing that we're seeing more and more is in the environment as a source of major conflict, but it's not something that I feel like we've discussed a lot in our network yet. I'm talking about issues, water scarcity, we were talking about land grabbing issues, but also other environmental issues that might lead to migration. So it's all very much interconnected, and we haven't really spoken about it in a very centralized way within our network. But I do feel that this is something that we need to devote more attention to. Sabad, do you have any thoughts on this, or maybe another trend that you'd like to highlight?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, because I was an ISG a couple of years ago. So, I know though, but still, I think I'm not in the position to answer the question. Yeah.
Well, this is building off of issues you mentioned earlier, that there are a lot of different approaches that youth bring to addressing conflict and building peace. In some cases, it's an art-based approach. In other cases, it's a dialogue approach. In others, it's a education and training approach. We are going to be releasing a course on media arts and peace building. So I have a present-day key interest in learning more about art-based approaches to peacebuilding. And you mentioned the organization that works in Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Beyond Skin.
Oh, it's called what?
Beyond Skin.
Beyond Skin. Yes. Excellent. Look it up. Check it out, folks, if you're listening. What are some other art-based approaches to peacebuilding that you find particularly interesting or effective or innovative from some of the other member organizations, like around music or the one you mentioned, theater in Northern Ireland, mm-hmm. or graffiti or poetry. You mentioned poetry as well, hip hop, things like that.
Yeah. Well, our member in Georgia, in the Caucasus region, they're working a lot with music as well. And again, it's because, as I was saying, we might not always have access to formal processes and arenas that we choose for these more alternative spaces where we talk about peace and security issues. But it's also a way of making some very sensitive, being able to actually address very sensitive issues that you wouldn't be able to address just by talking in words, sometimes by using music. That's one way of going about it. You've mentioned poetry or engaging with poets as another way of talking about peace building. It's not really an art-based approach, but one of the approaches that I find also particularly interesting is our member in Liberia. They're called Messengers of Peace Liberia, and they set up peace clubs in schools where they talk about nonviolent communication, mediation, but also seeing, which has also led to some of these peace clubs really intervening when there is an issue within the school around, I don't know, some elections official that they use the mediation skills that they have been discussing or developing in the peace clubs as a way of intervening in this conflict within the school. So I find, I've also found that a really interesting example of how we're able to use the skills and we're able to use the knowledge that we develop in different trainings and programs to also very concretely within a school, within your family or mm-hmm. within your neighborhood.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, here are my last two questions, and we spoke about this earlier today, but I think it's really important for our listeners to hear this as well. Both of you are currently working on a paper that looks at the barriers that young people face in engaging in peace-building processes, and then you've also developed some recommendations on how institutions, young people, organizations can overcome some of those barriers. Gizem, I was hoping that you could tell us what you have identified as the barriers that young people face.
Yes. So we conduct an annual impact review among our memberships, where it became evident that fundraising is every year by year, it's being indicated as one of the major challenges for youth-led organizations. As I mentioned, a majority of our members, they're volunteer-run. They're very cost-effective simply because they don't have much funding. And only 36% of all of the grant applications that were submitted by our member organizations have been successful in 2015. So it's really a major issue. And we spoke with different people from our network to find out what are the key barriers. Why is it so difficult for youth-led organizations to access financial support for their activities? And the first one, or highlighting three barriers now, the first one being the financial and technical requirements of grants. They're often youth-led organizations, especially the grassroots ones, they're not able to meet these requirements. They might require you to be a registered organization, and sometimes that's simply not possible if you're operating in a country where there's very little space for civil society to operate when they're seen as a opposition to the government. So sometimes we might be non-formal groups operating as non-formal, in the shape of a non-formal group. Sometimes our organizational history might not be documented in annual accounts and annual reports that the donor requires you to submit along with the great proposal that you've come up with. You might not be able to meet the income threshold for the grant itself. As I was saying, we're operating with very small funds. So sometimes we're just not able to meet the minimum of income that you're supposed to have in order to be able to apply for the grants. Second, the scope of the grants that are available to us. They're short-term. They're project-based. They're focusing on activities. They're focusing on bringing together a bunch of people in a room, doing really amazing things with them, but then sending them back off to an environment where nothing has changed, because we're not always able to address the structural drivers of the peace and security issues that we're trying to address in our work. We're not able to think of of more long-term sustainable approaches because of these restrictive short-term grants. It's also as we've already been alluding all throughout this conversation, we have different perceptions of peace building. Peace building is not only relevant in places where there is an active conflict. Peace building is a long process. Youth-led organizations often focus on preventative action. It's also relevant in the Netherlands, especially, again, going back to the resolution, it talks about political participation of young people as an alternative for people having to resort to violence to make their issues heard or addressing it. So these are all, yeah, so the way that we look at peace building and the different approaches that we might take and the different thematics that we might focus on, they might be slightly different than what an international institution would have envisioned or would have would consider a peace-building approach. Mm.
And so then what are some of the recommendations? So let's say I'm an organization that fully embraces Resolution 2250 and I want to be able to better integrate youth into our work. What are some recommendations you'd have for those organizations?
Yeah, so we do have a few recommendations that we'd like to share, and one is going to the barrier of criteria. So to counter that problem, if the language of the proposals, of that funding is made easy, if there are no jargons in that, and if it's a more easy language, it will be then more accessible for young people to have those funds, and also if there is a way of guidance and comments and some feedback from the donors to the youth-led peace-building organizations, and they also have a chance to revisit and revise their proposals, to revise their ideas of their work that they want to do. So this is in criteria, and then in the scope, actually, we have this. We have the recommendation that if the, in order to reach out to the groups that are harder to reach, the groups that are they may be non-formal groups. So to reach out to them, there can be the grants or like the funds can be given to the bigger established youth-led organizations, and they can serve as the administratives, and they can disperse the grants to more non-formal groups and to more community-based youth-led organizations. So it will make the process easier, and also it will give the opportunity to the smaller youth-led organization that might not be registered, they are double discriminated, or they are in far-off areas which do not have access to the bigger donors. They may not have access to internet, but they still will be able to do many programs that they want to do and many creative programs in their own communities. And also, if the funds have to be, the recommendation is that they have to be long term. So as you know, this was the barrier was that they're short term, and that's why the youth led organization most of the time they think on activity based programs are very short term. But if there are multi year grants, they will be able to at least think of the long term vision. They will be able to identify what they want to achieve in a more broader way, and they would not just put all their resources in having this 1 year grant. So that will be really change the scenario, and it will really change the whole picture. And also that if this funding can be diversified, as I said, yeah, so diversified, and it can be maybe non-financial institutional strengthening of these youth-led organizations. And then the third point of the understanding of peace building is that if the youth actually are being part of the selection processes among these donors. This actually process has already been practiced in some countries and in some donor agencies, in which young people are given the opportunity to make a decisions, you know, and give their inputs in decision making, that which grants have to be funded, which ideas have to be funded, and it would actually help and contribute to widen the scope of the work and of the subject.
Great, this is really, really helpful. So I got one last question for both of you, and then we'll bring this to a close. So we've had a great conversation. We've gone an hour and 15 minutes at this point. So again, I really appreciate you both taking the time. I know you've had a really long day, but I've certainly learned a lot. So my last question is, folks who are listening to this podcast, they've heard our conversation over the last hour and 15 minutes. What's one thing that you hope listeners walk away with in terms of how they understand young people or view young people as peace builders? Saba, why don't we start with you? What's one thing you want to make sure every listener of this podcast understands about young people as peace builders?
Put you
on the spot on that one.
Yeah, maybe I was thinking, okay. Well, no, I think that for the listeners that, you know, as you said, can you just repeat the question?
So that's, yeah, I mean, look, people spend an hour and 15 minutes listening to this. What's one thing that you want to make sure people walk away from this conversation understanding about young people as peace builders?
Right. So my message to all the listeners will be that there are young people who are good people, who are not bad people, who are doing amazing things. And there will be people actually around you. There will be young people around you doing amazing things, but you may not have a chance to listen to them. Or maybe you think that these are young people and they do not have that knowledge or their expertise. Or maybe you don't think that they are, maybe, you know, that they are knowledgeable enough that you will sit with them and talk to them. So if there is any chance, if the listeners, maybe in the coming week, or a couple of weeks, let's say, I will give you some more time. So just sit with one or two young people in your own communities, it can be in your workspace, in whatever settings you are, if you're a student. So connect with some young people and listen to them. And I'm sure it will change the whole perspective of a young people in your mind.
Thank you, Saba. Gizem, what about you?
I think what I would like our listeners to get out of this lovely conversation that we've had here, the three of us, is to be aware that even if the newspaper headlines are coming with all of these horrible statistics about what's happening in the world and these gloomy headlines and waking up to all of this bad news and the bad things that are happening around us, that I hope they also feel a sense of drive and hope, and also being aware that there are many other people like you that are not sitting on the sofa and just feeling powerless and frustrated by all of this, but that we are trying to make a difference. So many people of us out there, we need to connect, we need to learn from each other, and just gaining more inspiration and more energy from these stories that also they are being shared through this podcast, for instance, that we keep on feeling, being reminded why we're doing what we're doing and continually renewing our energy and our inspiration. And yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Our guest on today's show has been Gizem Killen. She is a leading coordinator for the United Network of Young Peace Builders that works with over 80 member organizations in 45 different countries around the world, youth-led peacebuilding organizations. Also joining us in studio today for the podcast as a co-host of sorts has been Saba Ismail. She is the co-founder of Aware Girls, an organization that works, a young women-led organization that works to empower women and girls and build peace in Pakistan. She was also a former guest on this podcast as well. So again, Gizem and Saba, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Darren.
Thank you, Darren.
You have been listening to The Peace Frequency. It is a podcast series searching for ways to create a world without violent conflict and finding them in the stories of people across the globe who are making peace possible. The Peace Frequency is produced by the Global Campus, USIP's online learning platform designed to teach and learn critical peace-building skills through distance learning, a growing multimedia library of peacebuilding resources, and virtual live events just like this one. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. Our theme music is composed by CDK. Our graphic designer is Manuel Leon, and I've been your host, Darren Cambridge. Thanks to all of you who are listening to this podcast. Be sure to check the Peace Frequency website to access a recording of this show and other archived episodes of the podcast. The URL is usipglobalcampus.org/peace-frequency. You can also subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Until next time, keep learning, supporting, and building peace.